Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. Lovers of freedom and libertarians in general are no fans of oppressive governments, obviously, and in some cases they will actually risk their lives, whether it's in China or in the days of the Iron Curtain in Eastern Europe or in South America, to fight back against dictatorships and totalitarian governments. But in democracies as well, they have a job to do, and that is not as risky. You're not risking your life, but you are certainly in for quite a struggle. And Charles Murray, the celebrated author of Losing Ground and The Bell Curve, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a man also with a good sense of humor, thinks he's found a way to do that in places like Canada and the U.S., take on government and win. Here's Charles Murray. Charles Murray, we have the usual rule on this show is that we never discuss a book until we've read it, not to insult the guest who wrote it, unless it's freshly out and the title is arresting, in which case we do mention it. And your latest book is called By the People, Rebuilding Liberty Without Permission, which has a very nice, sassy tone to it, and I think I can see where it's headed, but what does it say?
Well, very quickly, it says that we have a regulatory state that is trying to micromanage our lives, not through regulations that keep chimneys from billowing noxious smoke, but things that try to regulate the most minute, silly points of our life, mm-hmm. or regulations that are enforced idiotically. And the only way the government can get away with that is by overwhelming voluntary compliance. And what we need is some pushback. We need some way to say to the bureaucrat who is trying to enforce a really silly regulation, you know what, if you do this, this is going to be litigated, you're going to be publicized in ways you aren't going to like, you're going to be loaded down with work you don't want, and give the bureaucrats a reason to back off. So I'm advocating systematic civil disobedience backstopped by legal defense funds. And that's where the phrase rebuilding liberty without permission comes from, because you don't need to pass any laws, you don't need to get the right president or the right Supreme Court. We can do it ourselves.
And you use an analogy that's quite interesting, a turn of phrase that gets right to the heart of the matter. You say the government is Goliath, yes, and Goliath is all-powerful in front of David, except what happens if the Davids altogether sue Goliath all at once, then he's not so powerful anymore. And that's basic revolutionary logic.
Well, you know, I use another analogy, the Wizard of Oz. Now, of course, that plays differently to different generations. I don't know if the 20-somethings have seen The Wizard of Oz, but we old guys know that at the end of the movie, this fearsome voice that is so scary, a curtain is pulled aside, and it's this balding little old guy who's pretty pathetic. Well, the government can only get away when its booming voice is directed at us individually. Collectively, we can expose the government as the Wizard of Oz.
Also, you are hoping for saviors somewhere in all of this to pay for these actions, so that's part of it as well.
Well, the saviors for one kind of legal defense fund, which would be philanthropic, and it comes to the aid of small business people, for example, in the same way that in the U.S. legal aid comes to the assistance of poor people. But you could also have occupational defense funds. You could have physicians or veterinarians or construction workers or a variety of groups sort of develop a legal defense fund which enables them to go about their work at the highest professional standards but ignore a lot of silly and often counterproductive regulations that keep them from doing their jobs as well as they could.
So what you'd have is activists, really, groups of activists, Minutemen of the 21st century, paying a lot of attention to silly regulations. The minute they see them and spot them, then they target them with a lawsuit, and then it gets into the press and it goes from there. But you need it, I think, as a prairie fire. It has to spread very quickly to be effective.
Well, yeah, it does. And these legal defense funds need to establish a track record. But after that track record is established, you know what? All it will take is for some small business person who's been hit with an allegation that he has to pay a fine of $15,000 if he doesn't do something that's
right
going to cost him a lot of money. All he has to do after the track record has been established is say, oh, I'm happy to tell you that the such-and-such defense fund is taking my case. Uh-huh. And once that happens, and once the bureaucrat knows, uh-oh, if I pursue this thing, I'm going to be really in a lot of trouble I don't want to be in, they'll back off.
And on the other side of the fence, the ideological fence on the left, groups like the ACLU have been doing that for a long time. And they target very publicly, and they try to embarrass governments or corporations or whatever when they're not happy with something. And sometimes it works, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people just shrug and say, oh, yeah. In some cases, they will tremble, just like you described. But in other cases, they say, oh, yeah, the ACLU, okay, let them bring it on. Let them fight us. So it's hard to build momentum.
Well, the nice thing is that if there is a regulation that really is important, then and the government says no, we're gonna pursue this because we are convinced it serves an important goal. That's a screening process, But they're going to have to decide to devote resources to enforcing a regulation, whereas right now they don't have to use resources. Just making the threat, just making the allegation, is such that a person has to buckle under because they cannot individually afford to fight the federal government.
And it's a smart system because it may never get to court, and the court is the expensive part. So if it doesn't, as you point out, the press might do the mopping up and expose it, and that'll be sufficient.
Since the book came out, I've had a lot of people tell me that a lot of bureaucrats don't mind that people complain about the rules and regulations being stupid and pointless, but they do not like to be identified.
Uh-huh.
And that identifying that Joe Smith has alleged that somebody has to pay $20,000 because the railings on his staircases are 2 inches lower than the federal law says they should be. If that's the kind of thing that personalizes it, I am told this has a big effect. They don't like that. And I think we ought to take advantage of that.
And the overarching goal, I gather, as with all libertarian efforts, is to chip away at this mountain of regulation and red tape that weighs on us all.
Yeah, I want to make it easier for people to live their lives as they see fit, as long as they aren't harming anyone else. And you know what? An awful lot of what the government does now has nothing to do with us harming other people, and it has everything to do with, given the power to regulate, given the power to make rules and enforce them, people like to do that, and they keep on doing it indefinitely. And so what starts out with a few simple, important regulations that are justified ends up being the mountain that you just referred to.
And in a way, it's much more doable than the politicians' approach when they're campaigning, and to get more votes, they'll say, well, I'm going to abolish the IRS. I'm going to abolish the EPA. It never gets to that, whereas this is doable.
And you know, one of the reasons it won't happen, I spend a couple of chapters in the book talking about the way in which the government in Washington is this incestuous interaction between lobbyists and politicians and regulators. But the bottom line is, you can't roll back regulatory reach through the political process. That's just not going to happen. The only way it's going to happen is through the kind of direct assault I'm talking about.
So the bureaucracy, if unless you attack it in this way, the way you've just described, the bureaucracy is truly built to last. It's of better quality than some of the motors they're putting in cars nowadays. And it just, if you attack it inefficiently, it just morphs into something else, and it just transfers its mission and its budget. You can never get to the heart of it.
Yeah, well, you see, the problem is, Bob, that in the United States, by Supreme Court jurisprudence, it has been decided that it's okay for the Congress to pass a law that has some high-minded goal, clean water, clean air, saving the whooping cranes, a good goal, but very vaguely defined.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's okay to give to the regulatory agency, in effect, legislative power to create rules, to make up the rules as they see fit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? The definition of clean water can be wildly different depending on your ideological point of view. And so you end up with all sorts of things that Congress would never have passed on an up and down vote that are rules made up by the regulators. So they've been given that power to do it on their own, and it becomes a machine. And it's actually pretty much independent even of the president. The president can appoint the head of the agency, but that's about all.
He can't keep tabs.
Yeah, he can. And you know, they have the right to keep on making all these regulations, and they're going to exercise it. And the president cannot unilaterally say, "I want you to stop making regulations."
And let's say that this movement spreads, that this gets done the way you describe, and that it leads to something that I think is already there, a general consciousness in America that there is too much regulation, too much red tape. Let's say that that as well grows. What would it turn into? How would it affect the political reality? Would politicians start to write less laws? Would governments hire less civil servants? I mean, there'd have to be some kind of attrition to reflect all this.
Well, I'm hoping also for a judicial precedent that would have a huge effect. And I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on the legalities of all this, but right now the courts have explicitly said we will defer to the judgment of the regulatory agencies. We're going to assume that they're right, in effect. Mm-hmm. Well, suppose that we had a little tweak in that. Okay, you assume that they're right if they follow the rules in creating the regulation, but how about if the enforcement of that rule is arbitrary and capricious, to use a legal term? Mm-hmm. If the courts will say, we will intervene if the enforcement of the rules is arbitrary and capricious, that could have a big effect on how the whole enforcement process works.
There's another striking phrase from one of your books, another book, where you say, we have come to the end of the American project as the founding fathers envisioned it. And that's quite stark. And some people will immediately say, no, not possible. America is too great a democracy. And it is one of the great democracies in the history of the world, perhaps the greatest. There's a lot of achievement there. So you wonder, what is it exactly that's been lost? Is it a question of scale? In the early days of the Republic, the congressman came in on horseback and every second year sometimes and stayed for 2 months and left. I mean, it was a smaller thing.
Bob, the really important thing was there was no air conditioning. And so in Washington, D.C., that meant you did not stay in session.
So we have veered summer. From that.
No,
we haven't veered entirely is what I'm saying.
Well, no, the veering has been pretty substantial. There's a wonderful paragraph in one of the Federalist Papers where James Madison famously says that the real trick is first to have government that can control the governed, but second is obliged to control itself. Mm. And the Constitution contained the enumerated powers that strictly limited the government, federal government, to doing the things that were listed there. And what happened in the 1930s was not simply that we incrementally broadened the meaning of the enumerated powers. The Supreme Court explicitly said the government is not limited to those. It can spend on the general welfare. So that kind of change was huge and permanently releases government. In another decision, the government did what I alluded to earlier and say, you don't have to have an intelligible principle in the legislation that pretty much limits what you have in mind for the regulatory agency to do. It's okay to have vague goals. That also was a fundamental lifting of the restrictions on the federal government, and we are paying the price.
But isn't there the Ninth Amendment, for instance? I can see you're laughing.
I'm laughing because they had another decision, which in effect said the Ninth Amendment is gone. It was Caroline Products is the name of the decision. And not only did
that's the amendment that says all rights not specifically granted to the federal government are to the people.
Right. And
that should leave a lot of room.
That was supposed to be the whole reason for passing the Bill of Rights, because a lot of people back at the Constitutional Convention said, if you have a Bill of Rights, or after the Constitutional Convention, said if you have a Bill of Rights, then pretty soon the government's going to say, well, those are the only ones there are. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. That was the one who said, it's okay to pass the Bill of Rights because the Ninth Amendment takes care of that. This, by Supreme Court decision, it declared it would not subject to strict scrutiny laws that on the grounds of the Ninth Amendment, and even went further and said that the court would reserve for itself the right to decide which, even among the rights in the Bill of Rights, would be protected under any and all circumstances. Bob, it's hard to exaggerate the degree to which half a dozen decisions during the 1930s and early 40s just loosed the floodgates.
And it's hard to believe that there wasn't at some point a counter movement to undo that.
You know what happened? It's at the decisions are issued, but there's not a huge change in the next year or two. So that if you go up through the Eisenhower administration, 20 years after the beginning of the New Deal, to the beginning of the Kennedy administration, not that much had been done, but the potential was there.
Mm-hmm.
So things were constitutional that wouldn't have been before. And all it took was Lyndon Johnson coming to power after the trauma of the Kennedy assassination, huge majorities in Congress, where the whole thing started to gain momentum.
And then became the mountain.
Became the mountain.
Your book, The Bell Curve, changed, maybe not American society, although maybe a little bit, but definitely changed the intellectual landscape, the way we discuss American society. You were proven right on a number of things. And so I was curious in your more recent writings to see what you had to, what you thought of the so-called jobless recovery. And one arresting thought in there, you point out that it's not blue-collar jobs that are disappearing. That's the way we normally imagine it. It's white-collar jobs. Why did you say that? What did you mean?
This is one of the ways in which the bell curve, I like to point out, called the shot pretty accurately. Look, we're going to need plumbers for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to need good electricians for a long, long time. We're going to need stonemasons and things like that. You know what we don't need are a whole lot of white-collar jobs that require a certain amount of intellectual ability, that not just everybody can do them, but that now the information technology revolutions means they aren't necessary anymore. I'll give you an example, travel agents.
Yeah.
I used a travel agent all the time up until the early 2000s. And what happened in the early 2000s was that the websites for Expedia and the airlines and the rest of it and the hotels, they got really good. I didn't need a travel agent anymore. Well, it wasn't that the job didn't require a fair amount of ability. It is, you don't need that person anymore.
And it's true in that profession that you mentioned, the numbers bear it out. It's no longer a career to be a travel agent anymore.
And all the people who've made their living making decisions in white-collar jobs, not really tough, fate of the company decisions, but decisions that are now, you don't need them anymore. For that matter, we're seeing a revolution in, how long will it be? Let me put it this way.
Yeah.
How long will it be before you're better off telling your symptoms to a computer program than to your physician?
I wonder. I read that part too. I found it a little bit scary, honestly. I think that there's a case where we will continue to need a white-collar professional, namely the doctor, to do the diagnosis. Diagnosis by machine, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. Now, we are going to replace physicians, obviously. But, I think the long-term importance of the way in which white-collar jobs are being hollowed out is to emphasize the importance of local institutions and local communities and all the jobs that need to be done within them, where we're probably going to have a lot of human resources that can be devoted to them. And maybe, just maybe, we shouldn't be shipping the responsibility for civic culture to big bureaucracies downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we ought to be leaving those responsibilities where they belong, which is in the community where people are best able to make judgments and take advantage of a whole lot of people who are probably going to have a lot more availability for these kinds of functions of the civic culture than used to be the case with the old economy.
So in other words, we need white-collar workers to be more like blue-collar workers, not the opposite, as we had thought. They have to become more useful. It puts in mind that famous remark by Buffett when they asked him why he wasn't investing more in high-tech, and he said, well, the Dilly Bar, because he invested in Dairy Queen instead, the Dilly Bar is going to be around a lot longer than the latest software application, and he's been proven right, I think, and when you talk about stonemasons and plumbers, it's the same idea. We would need white collars to be as useful as that.
Yeah, well, we also need to have, you've raised a really big topic. There's a likelihood we'll have a lot of surplus talent in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as if there's nothing for them to do. It may not be paid work in the same way it used to be. And that gets us into a whole other set of issues where I think libertarians are going to have to think about how you deal with this. And I myself, and by the way, I will cite Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek as people who said the same thing, that having a basic guaranteed income to replace the welfare state, not augment it, but to replace it, is the way to go in terms of income security. And I would add that going that direction, just leaving, putting the money in people's hands, is also a way to provide the wherewithal for a lot of the responsibilities of communities to be once again taken up by the people who are in those communities.
But there's an irony there. You're the man credited with that, again, a famous phrase, with the end of welfare as we know it, which takes us back to the Clinton years and welfare reform. And you provided a lot of the intellectual underpinning for that. And now you're describing really money doled out for no work done.
It's independently of whether you're working or not.
Which has to be considered a kind of welfare, it seems to me.
Well, yes, it is income redistribution, okay? And one of the things that Milton Friedman says is, look, it's not perfect, but it's better than the system we have now. And I'm with him on a part of my book called In Our Hands that advocates this goes that route. But then I go to another thing. I say, look, the economy is evolving in ways which rewards people who have super high abilities, intellectual abilities and so forth. Well, nobody deserves their IQ. You know, you can deserve your luck to some extent because the old saying, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Mm-hmm.
That people can do a lot to shape their own success through hard work and initiative and the rest. You did not earn your IQ.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are lucky enough to have high IQs are living in an age which all at once all the goodies are coming their direction. I am okay with redistributing money so that people who work hard, pull their own weight, responsible for their lives, that they get money that they technically did not earn through the marketplace. And I think that libertarians are going to have to think hard about the extent to which they got to come to terms.
Because you've probably concluded, and you're not the first, that this cycle is different. Because previously in history, when we had, you know, the agricultural revolution, the printing revolution, the industrial revolution, a lot of jobs initially were wiped out.
But then you get more, lots more new ones.
Right. But you don't see them coming in this case.
You know what bothers me even more than that is the stagnation of wages. I mean, here's one thing that the left talks about all the time. They are right. Wages for working class jobs, and mm-hmm. for that matter, low-level white-collar jobs, have been absolutely stagnant in real terms. And they haven't gone down. The poor haven't gotten poorer. But the rich have gotten way richer. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? If you have the kind of rising GDP we have had, and you have absolutely flat wages at that level, I'm willing to say that is a problem. And you can't wish that problem away.
Powder keg.
You got to deal with it. So.
And it's built up anger. Something else you've said that's related to that I don't want to end without mentioning is the fact that, according to you, the white-collar jobs that are going to last and that are really going to be needed are white-collar jobs that have in common that they need conscientiousness, and that women in general exhibit more conscientiousness in their work than men do.
That was an insight that I got from Tyler Cowen, an American economist. And he's talking about the elderly, for example, or nannies.
Mm-hmm.
When you hire a nanny, or when you hire someone to take care of your elderly parent, conscientiousness is really crucial.
Sure.
And it is just a fact. Guys aren't as conscientious, on average, as women are.
So there's earning power in conscientiousness. Who knew?
Yeah, there's earning power in conscientiousness. But who knows? Maybe we guys have it within our grasp to become a little more conscientious, if that's what it's required. It's sort of like the old thing about guys getting married in the prime of their youth when they wanted to sow their wild oats, and they did it kicking and screaming, but that's because a lot of pressures pushed them in that direction. Well, it may be that we can respond to pressures once again, social pressures that are productive in this case.
Well, Charles Murray, there's a lot of conscientiousness in your work and maybe a little bit in our conversation today. So thank you. Long life and good luck.
Thanks so much.
Charles Murray was our guest this week on the Free Market series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.